You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jamie Skillen, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Director of Calvin Ecosystem Preserve and Native Gardens at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on his book, This Land Is My Land, Rebellion in the West. Also on the program today, Israeli troops amass at the Gaza border. At least 83 killed in Gaza, 7 in Israel. Biden slammed for giving Israel essentially a green light. Meanwhile, Colonial Pipeline, the one that shut down, now revealed paid $5 million to hackers for some form of a ransomware reversal. Former Trump Pentagon chief testifies that there was an organized conspiracy that drove the Capitol attack. The American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, says we need to be back 5 days a week to school in the fall. Bernie Sanders puts the military-industrial complex on notice. More scrutiny for defense contractors. Joe Manchin says he won't support Senate Bill number 1, but might support a slimmer John Lewis Act. Biden signs an executive order to boost federal agencies' cybersecurity. And the government launches the GetEmergencyBroadband.org. GetEmergencyBroadband.org. Millions of people, including many of you, will be eligible for $50 a month in a broadband subsidy. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. Thursday. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you. I hope you are the same.
I am.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Okay.
We'll work that out. We'll work out something that's a little bit less.
I'm because this is just your variants have been so painful that I'm desperate to get back to. Hi, Emma. How are you?
Great. Well, all right. And I think we will circle back to that. Everybody can anticipate something like that for Friday. That'll be pretty exciting to wrap up the week. Continue to watch, in many cases, with horror, what's going on in Israel, in Gaza, and in the West Bank, and throughout the country. I mean, many people who have been intimately familiar with this conflict over the years have said this is the most amount of widespread violence against the Palestinian people, against Palestinians, that we've seen in maybe in decades, because on one hand, we have this military conflict with an incredibly asymmetrical conflict. We have an incredibly powerful Israeli army and air force, and a population that is essentially in what has been described for probably a decade, an open air prison. But what we're also seeing, that is, we're not only seeing the violence perpetrated on Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, in this neighborhood that the Israeli government and settlers and sort of self-appointed, I hesitate to call them vigilante groups because they're really not responding to anything except for the existence of Palestinians living there, who are attempting to cleanse them from, to expel them from their own homes. We also have violence that is spreading around the country. I want to play this image of, comes from Louis Fishman. I don't know if he is the one who wrote an article in Haaretz about this. Is it the same person who shot it, Brendan, as wrote the piece?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, here is footage that comes from, I believe it's Bat Yam in Israel. It is south of Tel Aviv. This is a Palestinian-owned ice cream shop. And it is being attacked and by young Israelis. At the very least, I see Talis on some of these attackers. So it suggests at least some of them are very religious. I would imagine the vast majority of them are, frankly, which is not the case with Israel writ large. People should understand that. And it is it's incredibly disturbing footage. This is not, you know, a protest where people are starting to riot. It is an attack on a ice cream shop because it's Palestinian owned. Let's look at the footage of this, and it's particularly disturbing for people who understand and know the history of the Holocaust came about.
Kristallnacht.
Yeah. Yes. Yoruba! Yes. So this recalls Kristallnacht, which took place in the 30s in Germany and was one of the early signs. It was essentially an organized book burning and smashing of Jewish shopkeepers' windows, the night of broken glass. And obviously I'm just looking at the, you know, sort of the veneer of it is certainly, that's the first thing that I thought about. I mean, I don't know who those people are. I don't know the context. We don't necessarily have the same sort of, it's not a direct analogy. I'm just talking on a sheer emotional level. That is what the first thing that occurred to me when I saw those images. It's very incredibly disturbing.
Well, I mean, it's impossible not to think that, right? I mean, as I said yesterday on the program, we saw that footage of Mohammed El-Kurd, who has been on Democracy Now! On CNN and then recently on MSNBC explaining the Palestinian experience. He is a resident, I believe, of Sheikh Jarrah, and he was forcibly removed from his home yesterday after speaking out against Israel. And then you see images of glass being shattered of Palestinian shops. And as Sam said, I mean, how do you not think about these images? And how do you not think of the incredible irony and the sick cyclical nature of generational trauma from the Holocaust here? I mean, this is the targeting of an ethnic group, and in many cases, a different religious group, by a government that has is being led by a far right leader and has immense power comparatively. And I mean, there's a lot there. There's a lot there.
The this was the video, at least some people who posted it. One person, Lewis Fishman, wrote, I guess in a tweet, organized pogrom took place in Arabs in Bat Yam, despite the fact that they all learned about Kristallnacht. Today in my Haaretz article, I wrote, we need to see what a blatantly racist society we have become. I wish I had been wrong. That's this writer in Haaretz, but I think that sort of captures sort of the feel for that. Meanwhile, in at the White House today, Joe Biden, answering questions, had this to say regarding the conflict.
Are you concerned about the violence in the Middle East? And can you talk about what conversations you have had with officials there?
My national security staff and defense staff has been in constant contact with their counterparts in the Middle East, not just with the Israelis, but also with everyone from the Egyptians to the Saudis to the Emiratis, etc. And I had a conversation with Bibi Netanyahu not too long ago. I'll be putting out a statement very shortly on that. My expectation and hope is that this will be closing down sooner than later. But Israel has a right to defend itself when you have thousands of rockets flying into your territory. But I had a conversation for a while with the Prime Minister of Israel, and I think that my hope is that we'll see this coming to conclusion sooner than later. Thank you.
A couple of things that are really sort of stunning about this response. Again, the word Palestinian doesn't come up. He's spoken to leaders who are not directly involved in this. He's spoken to the leader that is waging, at the very least, at least one half of the war, but the violence that's breaking out across the country. I mean, leave aside for even the moment the rockets and the air power that is being unleashed here. What's happening across the country in terms of these attacks and in terms of these expulsions, we should in and of itself warrant some type of condemnation, repudiation, or conversation or addressing. But the idea that there's not even the word Palestinians does not even come up in that answer. And it is a completely open-ended question. It didn't even say Israel, Palestine in the question. They just said the violence in the Middle East. And the idea that there's not the word Palestinian doesn't come out of Joe Biden's mouth. And the idea that the Palestinians have no right to defend themselves, to protect their homes, to protect their ice cream shops, to protect their children. It's just it's sheer insanity. And I don't think that, again, this is one of those situations where I think the American public, and there's going to be a lot more pressure on the Biden administration, I think, than they have anticipated in this circumstance. We are in a different era, and I think we're at the beginning of that different era. And
83 people, including 17 children, killed in Gaza. No recognition by Joe Biden. No mention of the Palestinians, no acknowledgement of the power differential. And when, you know, people say, but Hamas, but the Palestinians, that is the equivalent of really saying all lives matter in the United States when talking about Black Lives Matter in response to that, because you are purposefully ignoring and willfully ignoring the power differentials and the use of state violence versus the people who are being oppressed and the apartheid. I mean, that is the framework with which Joe Biden is operating, and there is systemic racism involved in both of those scenarios. And there is a deep cognitive dissonance in Washington that, you know, Biden pretends to be woke all of a sudden now. But yeah, this includes that too. I mean, you've got to have an international perspective on this. It's like a disgusting statement by Biden, who seemed like he didn't even want to be there.
I have no doubt he didn't want to be there. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jamie Skillen. He is an associate professor of environmental studies and director of the Calvin Ecosystem Preserve and Native Gardens at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. His book, This Land is My Land, Rebellion in the West. We will talk about that in a moment. We'll be right back. In the meantime, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists, as you know, right now in particular, have long wait lists. It can take weeks, months sometimes before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Look, particularly during COVID, but frankly, at all times, very helpful to have someone to talk to work out specific issues or general issues. Therapy has always played a big role in my life at different times, more or less. But difficult, particularly right now. The stress is off the charts, even people coming back. I think there's a little post-traumatic, frankly, quality to sort of coming out of a pandemic and sort of this netherworld. Very good time to see a therapist. And the beauty of BetterHelp is that A, there are no long lines. B, once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if it is not a good fit, it's not working out for whatever reason, you can switch to a new one. You can do so at any time for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists. They're from all over the country. Sometimes maybe you're looking for a therapist who deals with a specific issue that you're having, a specialty. You can find them through BetterHelp. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the video description. If you're watching this on YouTube, it will be in our podcast description. If you're listening to the program, do we have Jamie? We do. Okay. I want to welcome to the program Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Director of the Calvin Ecosystem Preserve and Native Gardens at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, author of This Land is My Land, Rebellion in the West, Jamie Skillen. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Really appreciate you coming to talk to us about it. Essentially, what your book covers is really, on some level, the past 50 years of rebellions around the federal land use and control, and how over this period of time, the rebellions have become almost sort of less narrowly tailored and less sort of materially based. Or maybe I shouldn't say less, but they've expanded to be more almost ideological and sort of tied into sort of other ideas, conservative things that are happening around the country. I did not realize that when you're looking from the Rockies West, 45% of that land is owned by our government. In Alaska, it's over 60%. That is pretty stunning. But let's start with the Sagebrush Rebellions. I wasn't familiar with those, actually. And we should say that this is going to lead us up in some ways to January 6th in an odd way. But let's start with the Sagebrush Rebellions. What were they and why?
Right. It's a good question. And I want to emphasize, you know, it is such a different reality in the American West, where the federal government is the dominant land use planner. So the state of Nevada is 83% federally owned. So when the federal government sneezes in that region, people feel it. And the Sagebrush Rebellion, which sort of launched in 1979, is a reaction to a series of laws that Congress passed mainly in the 1970s. And those laws reshaped federal land management, particularly throughout the West. And for a lot of Westerners, particularly those who used what had been the public domain lands, and they'd use those lands with limited regulation, limited oversight, Congress's new laws sort of said, wait, we're going to have professional land managers make more of the decisions. And so particularly ranchers began to feel a real shift, that the ranches that had felt like their own were now being run by, you know, people with ecology degrees. And there was a frustration of the growing regulation and I think the reduced resource development. So I mentioned ranching, but also frustration with new developments in logging, in mining, and in other areas. And so the Sagebrush Rebellion is essentially when Western states, led by Nevada, began to pass legislation saying, incorrectly, that federal land rightfully belong to the states and not to the federal government. And as you said, that rebellion was really, it was a regional conflict. It was waged by Westerners who had a material interest in those lands and resources. And I should add, it was a bipartisan rebellion. There were Democrats and Republicans in those state legislatures who were fighting federal control.
Just speak to how aligned the interests were between ranchers, right, who are ostensibly, maybe characterize ranchers for us, because I when I think of a rancher, I think like, oh, it's a, you know, I don't know, it's a family, and they have their small plot of land, or maybe it's a little bigger plot of land, and they raise some cattle and maybe some other livestock, and it's sort of like the evolution of the Ponderosa, I guess. And then when I think of loggers and miners, I start to think of bigger corporations and almost like multinationals. Like where do they meet? How hard was that to sort of, I guess, cement that relationship so that they could provide some type of political pressure on particularly in Nevada in the late legislature?
In 1979, the Sagebrush Rebellion really wasn't focused on federal lands as a whole. So they weren't really arguing about national parks, for example. The focus was on what would be called public lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And those lands don't have a lot of timber value outside of Oregon. So the main issues were mining and grazing. And for a rancher in the West, it is very, very difficult to have a ranch operating entirely on private land. It's almost impossible. In the West, there are areas where you might need 100 acres per cow in order to feed them for a year. And so a rancher who might own, 500 acres privately held or deeded land might need 750,000 acres in order to make a good living. And so the ranchers in the West have historically been dependent on access to these vast federal acres just to survive. I mean, ranching in the Intermountain West, where there's very low rainfall, it's a tough way to make a living.
I mean, and this will come up when we start talking about the Bundys and whatnot, but how sure. Sort of like, how conscious was it that they're getting a government subsidy, right? I mean, like, I own some land, if it was private land, their neighbors probably wouldn't say like, yeah, sure, just have them come graze,
right.
You know, whenever it works for you guys, you know, we're okay right. with that. I mean, if it was private land, they'd say like, yeah, you can graze, but here's how much it's going to cost. And if you don't like it, you know, start a different business or something. How conscious were these, are these ranchers of that dynamic, or how do they see it?
So, you know, generalizing, what I would say is certainly in the late 70s, but even today, public lands ranchers don't see their access to the land as a subsidy. And part of it is we all understand ourselves through stories, through our history. And if you go back to when people settled the Intermountain West and began running livestock on those public lands, those lands were known as just the public domain. And there was no regulation. There was no management. There was no oversight. And that was legal. So what a lot of ranchers would say is they're the ones who were actually managing the land on behalf of the country. They were the ones putting in improvements like fences and wells and water. And to give an example of this, around 1930, 1931, President Hoover offered to give all of that public domain land to the Western states, and they said no, that they didn't want it. So for a lot of ranchers, it was this experience of, listen, we're the only ones who care about this land. We're putting our blood and sweat into it. So there was a real sense that there was an ownership of that land. And when the federal government began to regulate it, beginning in the 30s, ranchers were okay with a very, very modest fee. But they saw that fee as really just paying for the services of management. And when the federal government began saying, no, we're going to tell you how many cows you can graze, or we're going to tell you when the grazing season is, then ranchers felt like the federal government was really restricting their private property. And I think that sense continues today.
Tell us about the, I guess this is where the Bundy family comes in through these sagebrush rebellions. So when they're, you know, when their history goes back to the early 1900s, I guess, and their family, this, you know, this land presumably, right? I mean, for there to maintain their ownership, I guess it's pass it or down from my dad, from his dad, et cetera, et cetera. And I do mean dad, right? At least in the case of the Bundys. So what, just give us a little background as to their relationship to these rebellions.
Yeah, when Clive and Bundy, who is sort of the current patriarch of the Bundy family, when Clive and Bundy began ranching, he was working with his family ranch. And when he took over in the 1970s, this is just when federal regulation began to impinge on his sense of ownership and freedom. And so his ranch, like many in the West, he has private land, deeded land. He depended on tens of thousands of acres of federal land. And actually what he began to experience was just new regulations, higher costs that he was having to pay the federal government. And here, if viewers want to get into some of the weeds, that one of the really complicating issues that I'm empathetic with is there's an interesting relationship in the West between land and water that's hard to appreciate if you live in the East. And to say it very quickly, the Bundy family owns or has rights to surface water, and those rights are given by the state of Nevada. They can only exercise those rights if they have cattle grazing on federal land, drinking that water. And so when the federal government began to tell the Bundy family, hey, you can't have as many cows, not only was that hurting them economically, but they began to worry that they might lose their water rights as well.
Can you expand on that period in the 1970s when from the federal government, there were things like the Endangered Species Act coming down, and just how the confluence of those things informed, this exact dynamic, and then of course came to the head with the Bundy incident of right. a few years back.
Yeah, the federal government really wasn't involved in environmental regulation until the late 1960s in a meaningful way. And I'll just highlight three laws There was something called the National Environmental Policy Act, 1969, the Endangered Species Act of 1973, and the Federal Land Policy and Management Act of 1976. The first one I mentioned, the acronym NEPA, requires federal agencies to do a comprehensive environmental assessment when their actions are going to impact the environment. And that would include giving grazing permits. The Endangered Species Act, which you mentioned, when the federal government lists a species, federal agencies, land agencies included, are prohibited from taking any action that would harm species. And so those were already creating tensions. One of the key, that the third law I mentioned, though, is really important because the Federal Land Policy and Management Act is the first time that Congress said that the hundreds of millions of acres of land, public land managed by the BLM, was going to remain permanently in federal ownership. They'd never said that before. And that act also extended something called the Wilderness Act to public lands managed by the BLM. And so the agency was then reviewing land, looking for land that was appropriate to wilderness designation, which would close it to roads, which would close it to mineral entry. And so those three laws in the 1970s, were transformative. And I should add that I think what a lot of people like the Bundys would have felt is that politically, the environmental movement is what had power. I mean, those laws I mentioned were passed with bipartisan support. And so it was both the legal, but also that kind of political momentum that said environmentalists, and in the 70s, that would have been perceived, they would have been perceived as Easterners in particular, you know, were suddenly dictating how people lived in the West.
How many people are we talking about? Like, I mean, and we can maybe bring in the Hage family. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Sure. Yes.
And the Don sisters, and they pursued
the Dan sisters. Yeah.
Excuse me. The Dan sisters, they pursued a more, I guess, legal avenue than ultimately the Bundys did. And maybe their failure provided like some argument that, you know, maybe the legal paths aren't there, but I mean, how many people are we talking about here? I mean, in terms of like these ranchers in this class of people, are we thousands? Are we talking tens of thousands? I mean, you know, how do I know the name Bundy? I mean, aside from what they're doing, like, you know, it's right. Just, it's a family. Okay, great. But
yeah, we're talking about low tens of thousands of ranchers between across all federal lands. And so nationally, you know, they don't account for much in the way of beef production, right? It's not a nationally significant industry. It's a very significant industry locally for some small rural towns in the West. Now, what the agencies would tell you is that the majority of ranchers are also are compliant. You know, if every rancher were the Bundy family, we'd be having a different conversation. But the fact that the majority of ranchers will comply with regulations, you know, the agencies, you're not going to hear a lot of stories about that because that's just paperwork. But there are enough, and I would say a consistent number of ranchers whose struggle or, you know, rebellion against federal land law rise to a level, if not a violence, at least of significant threat.
Is that an indication that this is really more ideological than material in terms of their complaints with the government? I mean, obviously there are material implications. I have anxiety about losing my water, or I may or may not. But the other people are operating under the same sort of parameters as you are. You know, people deserve a certain breadth of you know, the range in which they should feel anxious about things. I'm not trying to dictate, but I mean, Is it an ideological, is the but for here in terms of these rebellions an ideological one that is buttressed by bigger economic interests?
Well, what I would say is if we look back at the the Sagebrush Rebellion of 79 to 82. I don't know how to quantify that, but I would say it's as much material or economic as ideological. And the shift, if we go forward to the 90s and the last decade, is that's the transformation, that it really is no longer about whether or not people can make a living. Now it's about a political identity, a political movement. So I do think it's by the time we get to the Bundy's standoffs with the federal government, it's a very different narrative.
So that takes us into the war for the West, or this is the era that you call it. I mean, what bookmarks that era, and why is it a distinct period of time in the development of this, I guess, ideology or conflict?
I'll back up just a little to say that, if we think of the 1960s, think about the rights revolution that gave us civil rights, particularly voting rights, women's rights. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, there was what one author has called the second rights revolution. It's where conservative, both industry and sort of social conservatives, realized that they were being beaten politically and decided to organize. So if you go down a list of the major conservative think tanks in DC, the major kind of social conservative organizations, whether that's Focus on the Family, the Cato Institute, you know, these basically were all formed in the 1970s or early 1980s. And so when the Sagebrush Rebellion happened, Westerners were kind of on their own. So one of the big changes by the 1990s is when Westerners stood up and were prepared to fight the federal government, they now had an entire sort of infrastructure of think tanks, of foundations, of political action committees that were able to magnify their voices. And that's also, though, it meant that Westerners are joining a coalition of people who their common, I think, complaint or grievance is federal overreach. So to your question, what marks that, most people, I think, would mark it with the 1994 election and the Republican Revolution. Newt Gingrich is associated with that. But when Republicans took control of the House, the war for the West really, though, goes back to the Bush administration, about 1990. And it's once again when the federal government was imposing new environmental management, new regulations. And George H.W. Bush was talking about things like a new world order. He was talking about wetlands protection. He was talking about biodiversity. And so it was actually a Republican president who sparked that. But now we had an entire infrastructure, political infrastructure, that was prepared to mobilize in defense of certain conservative interests.
And we should say that when you talk about these various Heritage, Cato Foundation, Focus on the Family, which is far more religious of an outfit than, let's say, Cato or even the Heritage Foundation, although the Heritage Foundation, you could argue that the subtext there is very religious. All of this, in many respects, was a reaction that came out of the Powell memo, written by Lewis Powell in the early 70s, which was a reaction both to the emancipatory movements that were happening at that time, but also in particular to the rise of environmental regulations, which Powell felt was going to encumber business. And so, I mean, that's where all this money comes from, right? I mean, like Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, all of these places, they're not getting their money by, you know, sending out flyers, contribute $5 to this. It's all corporate money. And this is when they find, I mean, what's going on, these sort of like regional, very regional, right? I mean, it's almost like not even like, it's almost a couple of states, really. These fights there are then adopted by this sort of greater Borg in Washington that is trying to push a broader narrative. They fit into that and they're getting support and they're amplified, and it goes both ways, right? I mean, these organizations use the instance of what's happening in the West to further the ideology of like an activist government is problematic. and the people in the West use this stuff to get a sort of ideological construct to carry their complaints more nationally.
That's right. If you think about, we'll have to go back again, though, to around, you know, 79 to 82. Ronald Reagan's genius as a politician was building this new conservative coalition. And it was not exclusively, but the big elements of this were a sort of business conservatism, an economic conservatism, and a religious social conservatism. So when Reagan says in his inaugural address, you know, government is not the answer to our problems, government is the problem, you know, he was able to speak simultaneously to some very different groups, as you say. To Westerners, that's about environmental regulation and land use. To Southerners, that's about the federal government's power forcing school integration and other civil rights issues. It's also for social, but particularly religious conservatives. It's the federal government weighing in on abortion. And then it's also, if we think about-
Well, we should say, let me just amend that.
Yeah.
It's also the federal government weighing in on escaping tax for institutions that don't allow integration. I mean, ultimately, correct, that was Bob Jones University, and the abortion came after,
right,
Carter's threatening to get rid of their tax exempt status. But go ahead.
Well, and then the third one I would say is this would be in the eastern part of the United States. Think about OSHA. That the federal government stepped in with occupational health and safety. So suddenly businesses are being inspected for their worker safety conditions. So Reagan could say to all those groups, listen, I understand the problem. The problem is us, the government, and I'm here to help you sort of roll back government so you can get back to the freedom that you ostensibly remember and used to enjoy. And so that is, I think, when we look at the 1990s, actually, an underlying piece of the frustration and of the rebellion, I think, was a disillusionment with Reagan, that Reagan had come in promising to get government off your back, and his success was pretty limited. I mean, he did that administratively while in office, but he couldn't get anything passed in Congress. So they went through 8 years of Reagan, and people discovered, wait, where was the liberation from government that we were promised? And so I do think the anti-governmentalism of the 1990s becomes more radical, just in part by that disillusionment or disappointment.
And it becomes more radical specifically with these types of people, right? I mean, or at least insofar as like Reagan delivered when it came to the corporations. Let's be, you know, I mean, that let's be clear on that, right? Like, you know, so much of what we see today, capital gains tax, buy back your own shares. Decreased regulation, lower taxes. He delivered for some people, and
sure.
And so when we see in the 90s, like a series of standoffs, how much of that, like armed standoffs, and things like Timothy McVeigh, how much of that comes out of this specific movement around federal land use?
Well, the way I write about it in the book is there were independent movements and that converged during that time. So there really were land-based disputes causing frustration in the West. But then, you know, part of what is happening with someone like Timothy McVeigh is by the 1990s, we have a fairly robust militia outfit in the United States. If you look back in the 1960s and 1970s, militias then were pretty explicitly racist, white supremacist. So these are the kind of Aryan Nation sorts of outfits. By the 1990s, the militia movement had rebranded itself as patriots defending the Constitution. And so Timothy McVeigh and, you know, what we saw at, say, Ruby Ridge in Idaho, what we saw in Waco, Texas, was unrelated to any land issues. What you see is there are two things. The first is you're seeing much darker conspiracy theories beginning to drive the extreme right. So these are conspiracy theories about the United Nations taking over, about the federal government imposing martial law. But then here's, I think, something really critical is this is also the point at which gun rights become almost inseparably merged with those other issues, land issues, you know, any kind of government regulation, private property rights. And so a lot of the things that we saw, I mean, the standoffs at Ruby Ridge and Waco, those were about Second Amendment and about a reinterpretation of the Second Amendment that, you know, is what we're used to now, that is far more radical.
And so then that takes us up into what you call the Patriot Rebellion, which is sort of, you know, Glenn Beck 9/12, I guess it is, right, type of time. And that is, and now we're even that much further removed from the issue of land use, but all of these themes now are beginning to converge into what ultimately became, like, you can't pass the Affordable Care Act because it's over 100 pages, essentially, is like what so how does this further that, and in what context is that, is that, I mean, does that explain, like, why people who have never walked on a, you know, a piece of soil where a cow has fed, you know, were huge Bundy supporters?
Right. I mean, Sean Hannity did a week of his show at the Bundy Ranch. And even then in, you know, 2016, I remember Marco Rubio, right, senator from Florida, on his campaign, he was denouncing federal land ownership. And really what that is, you know, that's just sort of making sure there's the nod to the peculiar Western interests within this broader coalition. I think when I, you know, it's amazing to me. I started this book and, I thought of this book in 2016 during a second Bundy standoff. And
One in Oregon.
Correct. And I had thought about this in 2014 when there was a standoff between the Bundy family and law enforcement at the Bundy Ranch. And at the time, it was sort of mind-boggling. How could this be happening here in the United States? One reporter asked me that. And, you know, fast forward to 2021 and you're kind of like, well, that sort of thing is Tuesday's news, right? I mean, we've almost become accustomed to that being a normal part of the American news cycle. And I think when we look back at, I call it the Patriot Rebellion, it coincides perfectly with the Obama administration. You know, we have passage of the Affordable Care Act that is a useful tool, right? But there is this anger against the federal government that's bubbling up. And we have what I would think of as the mainstream Tea Party. And this is espousing a kind of political ideology, you know, a staunch libertarianism. But we also have the growing strength of, I see it as the Tea Party's armed wing. I mean, the militia movements, like the 3% Patriots. And all of a sudden, the line between mainstream and extreme all but disappeared. So at those rallies, you know, that you'd see on the mall that Glenn Beck would host, Glenn Beck would denounce violence, but look out at the crowd and sort of see who's joining him there. Similarly, we started to see, you know, a sort of extreme rhetoric about the potential need to kill federal authorities in defense of one's rights. You know, that became more and more mainstream, sort of accepted even among sitting politicians. And so I think that was a real warning sign that, you know, I wish more people had listened to, because what we've seen even this week with the removal of Liz Cheney is, you know, that what we see now in a movement is really not about conservative principles anymore. I mean, it's ideological, but it's not about the sort of conservative principles of Reagan or even what Cheney upheld. I mean, it really is about a kind of raw power for its own sake and the means of maintaining that power. And this is a minority of people. I'm not suggesting conservatives are all violent, but the minority of people that were willing to go and storm the Capitol the minority of people that, you know, in my state of Michigan, who plotted to kidnap my governor, you know, this has sort of become a mainstream part of our politics. And that's part of what I find so both terrifying and horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, I think I am maybe a little bit less convinced that there were those conservative, I don't know how you phrased it, values or ideological foundations.
Sure.
were a little bit Potemkin as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I think like, I mean, look, Lynn Cheney was, you know, the iteration and certainly Dick Cheney was the iteration, just sort of like, you know, Donald Trump 1.0 or maybe Donald Trump 2.0 and Donald Trump is, you know, Donald Trump 4.0. I don't know. But I think like these are just more sort of like refined versions of the same. This progression, right, has been heading there. But that idea of violence, are there other strands? I mean, so I can see the one that comes from like the Bundys looking at the other people in their specific situation, right? The Don sisters or Dan sisters, and losing legally. So they decide, or that's maybe it's not so straightforward. They decide, but that the options become more of violent and they begin this notion of violence against the government when you don't get what you want, essentially, it becomes more acceptable just because more and more people adopt it. What other strains led into that specific dynamic of the violence? What where else was that coming from?
Well, yeah, coming from a number of places, I think that the one thing to note is throughout, whether it's the riot on the Capitol, the assault on the Capitol, whether it's rallies, whether it was the Bundy standoff in Nevada or Oregon, you know, look for the symbols and listen for the rhetoric about things like the American Revolution, right? About, you know, the Gladstone flag, don't tread on me. That part of what's valorized in this is, you know, the myth of American independence, where what it took to overthrow the tyranny of the federal government was a violent uprising. And, you know, we still teach that as, you know, the liberation or the birth of the country. And so I think basically within the rhetoric, there's a kind of martial tendency, though I assume a majority of people don't mean that they want a literal revolution, but a percentage of people do. A couple other places that I would point to, one, I already mentioned some of the key militia movements. I mean, the militia organizations, which have grown in number, but these are groups that train regularly. And the assumption is that the federal government or state governments are going to come and take your guns. And you have to be prepared not to. And the rhetoric would be, we're not going to be the aggressors here. But when the federal government comes to violate my constitutional rights, I'll be prepared to defend myself. And this is important, I think, to think about, which is what gives that movement or people in the movement, I think, that sense of power, of purpose, of meaning and belonging is precisely the fact that they're talking about possibly dying for their country in some abstract sense, possibly needing to kill for their country. Now, it's clearly not for their country, but I think the other movement that is deeply concerning is something called the Constitutional Sheriffs. So there's an organization, Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, but it's an odd and clearly erroneous belief that county sheriffs are the highest elected law enforcement in the land, and therefore they are the highest, not only law enforcement, but sort of legal interpreters. And so for a sheriff who buys into the ideology, the assumption is if they individually believe that a law from the state or federal government is unconstitutional, they have not only a right, but a duty to oppose it. And so I think what you're seeing there is perhaps the most destructive, because now we have, you know, people in uniform bearing the symbols of rule of law who are the very ones undermining law. I mean, in my own state, after the Wolverine Watchmen plotted to kidnap Governor Whitmer, a sheriff to the county just south of me, Dara Leaf, said that, well, that might have been seen as a legitimate citizen's arrest because Whitmer had violated the Constitution. So the last thing I'd add is all of that then assumes, and this is also a bit frightening, a kind of populist understanding of the Constitution, that at the end of the day, I and I alone am the final authority in determining what the Constitution says. Elitists like judges, they can't be trusted. And so that's where there's the rhetoric of rule of law, and yet everything that we see, the actions, are fundamentally undermining the rule of law.
And I should just say, we've got to wrap it up here, but those people you're talking about, the sheriffs, they had to be ushered out of former Governor LaPage's office in Maine by his advisors at one point, because LaPage was meeting with them and they were suggesting you can assassinate members of the legislature. Really? Don't agree with you. I mean, that was a couple of years back, but yes. And I imagine we're going to see a lot more of this under a Biden administration. It is because they're going to know they're not going to get what they want, rather than having to wait as they might have done during the Trump administration. Jamie Skillen, the book is This Land Is My Land, Rebellion in the West. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the program.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, then we'll come back, wrap things up. We are back. I have been corrected that I said Lynn Cheney again, yeah, as opposed to Liz Cheney.
Have you ever considered hypnosis?
Look, I think everybody knows who I'm talking about at this point. Cheney. That's how I'm going to refer to her from now on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just save yourself.
This part about the sheriffs, very scary. And you can go back into history, folks, and these type of anti-government assaults happen predominantly during Democratic administrations. So buckle up. We are not done. And with the encouragement they're getting from members of the House and, frankly, the Senate, we can expect more of this type of thing. And it will grow. It will grow. And that is our time for today. Emma and I will be back tomorrow, Friday. See you then. And for those of you who are not watching us on Peacock, see you now. Emma is going to lead us into the fun half. We're anticipating old Matt will show up and Brandon Sutton will be here. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, I am $1 closer to getting hypnosis so that I can remember it's Liz and not Lynn Cheney. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. And check out the AM Quickie. And
you know why you're saying that, Sam? That's his wife.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. It's Lynn Cheney is his wife. Yes, right. No, I'm not. I am, yes.
Okay.
And I've, you know, been talking about Lynn Cheney for years. It's a story. I am not going to get into it now, but.
Right.
Yes. So it's not just a forgetting. I confuse her with her mom.
I forgot her name was Lynn.
And so. I don't call her Mary Cheney. Right. So, which is the other sister who Liz Cheney basically threw under the bus because mm-hmm. she had to get elected and didn't want to be associated with a sister who
was gay.
who was gay and was for marriage equality. But that's it for me. Don't forget, you can check out Nomi Show, the Nomi Key Show. You can find that at youtube.com, the Nomi Key Show. And also, old Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
How you doing, Sam? You guys hear me? Just making sure.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder at 9 p.m. Eastern time, I will be joined by Ryan Haas and Conrad Wilson of Oregon Public Broadcasting to discuss what happened to Michael Reinhold. Now, he's the guy who last year got into an altercation in Portland with a Patriot Prayer member. There was a shooting and he was a wanted man, and Trump basically went on TV as president and called for this guy's head, and he died by the hands of police who were trying to apprehend him. They've told one story, but OPB has done great work looking into this. And over the past few weeks, there has been some revelations into what the police did, how they found him, how this really went down. And we'll find out as close as we can possibly get to what really happened to Michael Reinhold.
I heard some rumors that there was a possibility, and this is just completely speculative, I just want to put that right out there, that that Reinhold may have had some pre-existing relationship with the police department. There was some, you know, talk about that. I'm curious. Let's ask them about that.
If there was
like some type of like CI situation or something like that. Not sure.
There was a dynamic like that with the Boston bombings. If memory serves too, there was a book about that. So that seems to happen quite a lot.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, ask about that. Be sure to tune into that tonight, folks. Brandon, how are you? You seem so quiet today.
I'm sorry, I was muted. That wasn't the result of any sort of lingering infection. I'm doing great, Sam. Thank you for asking.
You vaxxed?
Half vaxxed.
All right, just checking. And what's happening on the discourse?
You know, every time you ask me that, I make a very modest promise to get something done. And then, like, I'm beset on all sides by bad luck, like sinus infections or like car accidents. So I'm going to say...
You got into a car accident?
Not me. But I will say, so this time I'm going to give a very ominous something, you know, we're going to do something.
I see. With your show.
Yes. Right. Yes. We're going to do something with my show. I don't want to jinx myself this time.
Okay. All right. I see. All right. Well, something's happening on the Discord. People can check that out. And Matt, is there anything happening on, in the Matt Leckian universe of media?
Tonight, Matt Huber talk about his Jacobin piece. Rich people are feeling climate catastrophe, but not mostly because of their consumption. We talk about the correct way to loathe rich people for what they're doing to the climate. And it's not for like buying stuff.
I interviewed him on Peacock, Matt.
Oh, very nice. Excellent. Yeah, I'm excited about it. And also for we released patron only content. I'm going to actually share the screen here. This is our radical tradition, a series we're doing, David and I, with Paul O'Connell, talking about Irish revolutionary James Connolly. And people should check this out. It was the anniversary of his death. Exactly yesterday. So we release that for everybody. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel and watch that. And tonight, 8 Eastern with Matt Huber.
All right, folks, I will say adieu. The number is 646-257-3920. I'll be back tomorrow. Till then, bye-bye. Fun half.
Here we go.
Fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.